So, thanks very much, first of all, to Jean-Paul and Dan for inviting me here to speak today. This is really my attempt to put a little English on a classic interpretive question in the history of patenting life. And I'm going to try and do that by asking, why didn't an equivalent to the US Plant Patent Act of 1930 emerge in Britain? So, when I first started researching this paper, although it's been on my mind for a long time, I thought, well, you know, the British parliamentary papers are now fully digitised and searchable online, so I can just type in plant patents. I'll find some Edwardian top saying, oh, we don't want plant patents for reason X, and I wouldn't have to be wringing my hands, I'd just be slapping them. But unfortunately, that's not the case. So instead of that kind of smoking gun evidence, and bearing in mind that, you know, it's worth being wary of an absence of evidence, what I've got to offer instead is a series of kind of vignettes, which hopefully give a character of what was happening in British plant breeding, and hopefully add up to some kind of explanation for why something like the PPA was unlikely to be on the British legislative table in the 1920s. Okay, so first stop on our tour of Britain is going to be the Royal Horticultural Society's third international conference for special hybridising and plant breeding techniques. And this is quite a famous event in the history of genetics anyway. It's the first occasion when William Bateson uses the term genetic publicly. And the Reverend Wilkes, who published the report of the conference, renamed the report in his honour, the RHS conference, International Conference on Genetics. And it was the first of a series of conferences. So, while Bateson and the Mendelians were very much front of house at the conference, and it was a massive affair, I mean, it's quite hard to estimate just how big it was, but for example, when the conference relocated to Cambridge from London, they had a special train laid on for just the attendees of the conference. So, while all of that was happening front of house, plant breeders came together backstage to discuss whether they could take out some kind of copyright, they called it, they weren't quite sure, maybe they were thinking of patents as well, over their new varieties. Okay. So, one breeder in particular mooted the idea, and he was called Mr. Paul Douglas. He was a rose breeder. He turns up, actually, I think, in Petra Moser and Paul Rhodes' examination of plant breeding, rose breeding after the PPA, actually. And he opened the proceedings like this. He said, "Plant breeders needed rights, quote, for all the risk and labour added to the observations and experience which have taken the best part of a man's life to amass." And he noted that there were many reputable breeders who were missing from the conference. And he surmised that these breeders were missing because these gentlemen do not like to tell us or to show what they have done in their experiments, because once their knowledge becomes public, they have not the slightest chance of receiving any pecuniary reward for their labours. Okay, so that was one view that was on the table at this session. But it certainly wasn't the only view. And so in response, another plant breeder, Mr. James Douglas, says, "It appears to me that protection would cut both ways. Mr. Poole propagates other people's roses, and other people propagate his. It is perfectly fair. We do not want to restrict the sale of plants, but to increase it." And in the end, the people who were at this particular session, according to the Reverend Wilkes' report anyway, were kind of split 50-50 down the middle. There was no consensus of opinion. And so the chairman at the session concluded by saying, "The point raised by Mr. Poole is a most interesting one, but there are evidently two sides to it, as to most other things. And unless there were a very decided majority in favour of it, I do not think it would be wise for us to move in this matter." So it seems that there was a lack of coherence amongst British plant breeders on the subject of whether they even wanted rights. And this chimes with something that Margaret Llewellyn and Mike Adcock have noted in their quite legalistic history of the genesis of EUPOV. They commented that the development of the right would not have occurred had it not been for the widespread commitment of the breeding community. So, what sort of shape was the British plant breeding community in at this time? Well, to take the temperature of British plant breeding, we can turn to an American. So, George Harrison Shull, who's much more famous for his involvement in the F1 hybrid story, and about whom Christoph knows a great deal more than me, on his way to the Dublin meeting of the British Association for the Advancement of Science, he met up with Bateson, they travelled together to the meeting, but beforehand, he took a tour of the great British seed dealing houses. And this is what he found, time and time again. He visited Thomas Rivers nurseries, the Laxton nurseries, and the only exception to the picture that he found generally was at the Suttons. But on the main, he found there was a great deal of commercial activity. So many tons of apples and other fine fruits are sent to market every year, and great quantities of nursery stock are sold. However, the breeding work has been necessarily simply a side issue and has been carried on largely for the sake of advertisement. And this is really a picture that we find time and time again with British plant breeders in the period. And it's worth noting that these are largely Darwin's go-to guys when he was writing Variation. These are old patriarchal established firms who were at the height of their powers in the mid-19th century, and by the seams of it, by the 20th century, had largely become seed dealers. Okay, so we continued. Oh, sorry, I've done that bit. So, if commercial breeders weren't doing much breeding, and on the whole, much more dealing, then who was doing any plant breeding in Britain? So, in the period, men like Roland Biffin, who was one of the new Mendelian breeders, were increasingly taking over the job of plant breeding. And they were doing so with funding that was made available to them through a new body set up by David Lloyd George, who was then Chancellor of the Exchequer, and a young radical liberal MP, Winston Churchill. And the Development Commission was £1 million fund initially that was set up for rural reconstruction. So many of the projects involved dredging estuaries, road improvements, and some considerable funds for plant breeding. So the doors opened 1912, Biffin began working at his own plant breeding institute, established at the University of Cambridge. And the funding that Biffin received was often justified with a particular image of the man and his work. So for a flavour of that, this is a quote that was taken from the question and answers session at one of Biffin's many public performances in front of farmers. And it's one Mr. E. Laxton, possibly of the famous Laxton family. And Mr. Laxton said he thought the meeting did not recognise the great work that Mr. Biffin had been doing for agriculture. But in a few years, they would look upon him as one who had added to their incomes. He knew from his own experimental work how immense was the labour and expense of producing new varieties. Mr. Biffin was devoting his life and brains to bringing out new wheats that would add to the well-being of the country and of the world. He thought they little knew they were entertaining an angel unawares. So, this picture of Biffin comes up time and time again. And really, this was a project that was in the ascendancy in the years before the war, but it was interrupted by the war. And Britain had a quite peculiar experience of the First World War. So in 1915, the country came perilously close to mass starvation, and this was for a couple of reasons. So on the one hand, British agriculture was coming out of a long period of depression, and on the other hand, German U-boats were cutting off supplies from the merchant navy. In response to this near starvation, David Lloyd George, who was then Prime Minister, set up another body called the Food Production Department. And the attack was three-pronged. So in the first place, all agriculture in Britain was nationalised. The government could tell you what to grow, where and when. Secondly, fixed prices for wheat were introduced. And the Wheat Act, as it was known, ran on into the early 1920s. And thirdly, a forced plough policy was introduced. So parks were ploughed up, any green space was ploughed up and converted to wheat production. Okay. During the war, Biffin was seconded away from his Mendelian experiments and he went to work for the Food Production Department. And there he met Lawrence Weaver. Okay. So after the war, Lawrence Weaver and Roland Biffin began working on establishing another institute, the National Institute of Agricultural Botany. So the idea was Biffin would produce varieties and these would be distributed by NIAC, as it was known. And this is just one of the focus pieces that appeared at the time, promoting the idea and the need for the new institute. So the author is Harold Begbie. He's writing for the Daily Mail. Like many of these quotes, they come from the newspaper cut. They come from the newspaper clippings collection that was collected by Mary Biffin. And Begbie says, "No seed merchant can do what this National Institute would undertake. It is unreasonable to expect the seed merchant to conduct experiments over 8 or 10 years, subject each step in his process to milling and baking tests, corresponding with men of science all over the world, even in Tibet, as Professor Biffin does, when at the end of it all, there is nothing patentable. A seed, once on the market, is everybody's property. The seedsman has done good and patriotic work, but we must not expect too much of him." Okay, so these plans were a success. In 1921, NIAB was opened to the public. The opening was accompanied by a visit from the King and the Queen at the time. There was much fanfare and to-do. And roughly 3 years later, the first purely publicly funded, and I've removed the word Mendelian here for Christoph's sake, possibly Mendelian variety of wheat, was introduced to the market, and this was Yeoman 2, and this is a well-grown plant of Yeoman 2. So Yeoman 2 was only available from NIAB, and the price was fixed, and it was fixed low, and it was sold in sealed sacks, so the identity was certain, and Yeoman 2 lives on. This is a sample that was grown at the John Innes Centre for their centenary anniversary last year, the year before last. And it was also widely pirated. So this is a sample from a catalogue produced by Carter's. And you can see here Yeoman King, which is handily placed next to, but with no scale whatsoever, a sample of Yeoman ear of the original wheat stock. And you can see how much more ennobled and kingish this Yeoman King is. This irked Biffin, and it irked him greatly, not least because Carters were using some kind of Darwinian selection to induce this ennoblement, as they called it. And time again, Carters, or dealers like them, would take Biffin's varieties, make kind of minor changes and rearrangements and put them on the market as their own. And so Biffin quite publicly chastised Carters for this, In 1926, he published his fullest account of his own work, in which he said, wheat selection, however, is still practiced, or said to be practiced, by the seed trade, but it is improbable that their efforts will lead to any improvement in the crop if one story of the most recent pedigreed wheats, A's XYZ, is typical of the modern methods of selection. A's XYZ was, of course, Carter's ennobled yeoman. Biffin had friends in powerful places, so the Prince of Wales, HRH, speaking at the British Association for the Advancement of Science in the same year as this advert appeared, said, "At the Plant Breeding Institute at Cambridge, Sir Roland Biffin has provided several new wheats, of which two are generally grown throughout the country. The extra yield and value of these wheats must already have more than repaid the whole expenditure on agricultural research since the Institute was founded." So, what did the commercial breeders and dealers that we touched on at the beginning of the paper make of these new developments? Well, they didn't like them, frankly. So in 1920, just before opening the Institute, NIAP had tried to establish a trademark, and they'd wanted to use the word national in the trademark. Carters complained immediately. So they'd been using a trademark that they'd established in 1919, which also contained the word national. And the nub of their complaint with NIAP's trademark was, firstly, that it implied by its national status that this was the only choice, and because it was government mandated, the only right choice to make. Equally damaging was the idea that people might possibly confuse NIAP seeds for Carters. The case rumbled on for several years. There was a lot of to-ing and fro-ing at the British Patents and Trademark Office, and in the end, neither of the companies used the word national in their trademarks. And this was probably, at least in part, because the view of the president of the Board of Agriculture and Fisheries, that he strongly deprecates any individual firm of English seed merchants obtaining a monopoly of the word national in connection with the seeds sold by them, has already been communicated to the Patents Office. So, in the 1920s, we find British commercial dealers of seed struggling even to secure trademark protection over their varieties and crops. So, what does this all add up to? Well, I don't want to be accused of bringing coals to Newcastle, and I'm slightly wary of trying to make any kind of historiographic intervention on the American case while Dan's in the room. But nevertheless, I'll try. Okay. So, I think looking at the BPA, one can possibly discern three large sets of causal factors for its introduction. And the first, I would say, is geographic. And of course, I wouldn't imply that Dan is giving any sort of determinist picture based on one or other of these causal factors, but a complicated integration of several of them and others that I've skipped over. But nonetheless, geographic. So we've heard a lot today about expanding markets. The wonderful phrase was the golden age of fraud from Brendan. The
golden age of deception.
The golden age of deception. So a big part of the campaign for the PPA was the argument that breeders like Luther Burbank on the west coast needed to be protected from pirates on the east coast. Well, you might think that this wouldn't have mattered so much in Britain. Not so. Carters were expanding into the Australian and the American markets, which were just as distant. And of course, there was always France. So many French varieties ended up on the British market being renamed, and I'm sure a few British varieties ended up on the French market as well, with similar impunity. So really, British breeders faced a similar problem to do with the collapse of these types of community-based chastisement. So another set of factors we might call the scientific. And there's a kind of crude scientific determinist view here that the new Mendelian theory improved plant breeding such that legislation was obvious and necessary. Kerry Fowler is at particular pains to dismiss this view. And a more nuanced view is that these new scientific theories allow breeders to make claims to inventorship status. So Thomas Edison was a large part of the campaign for the PPA, and breeders very much like to align themselves with that type of inventor rather than naturalists or butterfly catchers. Well, Roland Biffin was just the same. He was very fond of claiming that the new Mendelism allowed him to build up new varieties with exact precision in a thought out way. So I think the real difference between the two situations comes under what I've kind of loosely, roughly, and probably badly called social causes, if you like. So the types of arguments put forward in the first two cases were put forward by, in America, largely Paul Stark. I think Aaron's right in saying that the BPA might well have been called the Paul Stark Plant Protection Act. Without a Paul Stark figure, it seems unlikely that it would have come into existence at the time that it did. When we turn to Britain, and of course Paul Stark was incredibly important, not least, for bringing along the American Breeders Association and the American Sea Traders Association. So when we turn to Britain, we find that the Paul Stark equivalents, if you like, I would say it's going to be Roland Biffin or someone like him, are deeply embedded in a publicly funded research context, right? So the problem that I have to face down here is that there was lots of public funding going on in America at the same time, right? Well, for a comparison of the flavour of the work that was done at these two contexts, we can turn to a quote that's from Raymond Pearl, writing to Carl Pearson in 1909, that I've unashamedly stolen from Dan, who did the hard work in finding it. And he wrote to Pearson about his work at the Maine Experimental Station. "I am under no restrictions as to giving a practical turn, In comparison, Biffin, writing to the Ministry of Agriculture in 1915 to report on his work, said, "A great deal of the work is now of a routine nature, and the results, consisting mainly of records of yields and new varieties, are of too little general interest to publish." So, hopefully I've made a start on looking at this comparative picture between the UK and the US. Of course, there still needs to be a great deal more done, especially in terms of the European picture, where the public-private mix was very different once again, and the flavour of the work being done in those respective spheres was very different once again. But I think the important take-home message, if you like, is that there were interesting moral and patriotic reasons why a legislation that would have given personal rights to a publicly funded breeder like Biffin would have seemed very unacceptable in this period in Britain. Okay, thanks ever so much.